Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Hoyas basketball, WTEM, Washington, the Team 980, a radio.com sports station. Knowledgeable.
Listen, here's what's wrong with your hypothesis, your theorem, your supposition, your postulate.
Honest.
If that front ain't in gangsta, your back end won't be able to show its full potential.
Understanding.
You're going to suck. You're going to suck for the next couple of years.
Passionate.
I'm all over social media. I live it.
This is the Kevin Sheehan Show on the Team 980 and the Radio.com app.
Hashtag facts.
It's the Kevin Sheehan Show. Now, here's Kevin.
Second down, 10, Buccaneer 38, Brady in the gun. Gets the snap, drops back three, sets and winds up, long pass down the far side, intercepted! That'll do it! Troy Hill has picked off Brady on the far side. Or do they give it to Fuller? I think it was Jordan Fuller. Yep, Fuller makes his second interception of Brady tonight on the far sideline at about the 37.
Wow. Tom Brady last night. Two interceptions, including that one, when, for whatever reason, Sean McVay gave him plenty of time down three at the end. A good Monday night game. We had good primetime games in week 11 of the NFL. Started off with that Seahawks-Cardinals game last Thursday night. The Sunday night game may have been the best played game of the year between the Chiefs and the Raiders, and last night was exciting too. Good morning. Anthony's here with me today for the next 3 hours. We've got a lot to get to. Mike Wilbon will be our guest today at 8 a.m. We've really ignored, we had Tommy Shepard on the show last week, but for the most part, we've really ignored a lot of what's been going on in NBA free agency. But Wilbon's got some football thoughts as well. So Mike Wilbon at 8 a.m. this morning. You'll hear what Ron Rivera said during his press conference yesterday about several subjects, including Chase Young and how he views division games versus the other 10 they play during the course of the season. We will get to all of that. And more. The game last night was actually, you know, the Buccaneers were a 4.5-point favorite. I didn't like the game either way. Didn't play it. It's not rare, and by the way, shouldn't be for you either if you're a bettor, to just stay off the Monday night game if you don't like it one way or the other. A lot of you were asking me on Twitter, who do you have tonight? Do you like the Rams? They seem like they would be a smell test pick. Not really. The line was right. Tampa should have been favored. They were favored by 4, 4.5. The action was pretty much split down the middle. I sort of liked the Rams before the game. I think they're a very underrated defensive team. And when I say underrated, I think a lot of people that are really paying attention to the league, not just our team and the teams we're playing. And we did play the Rams. The Washington football team played the Rams. But I think the Rams are pretty damn good defensively in a lot of spots. And they've proven that. They're actually in the number one statistic used to cite defensive ranking, which I think is a limiting statistic. It's a very simple and traditional statistic. Yards allowed. The Rams are the number one defense in the league, followed by the Colts, who I think are excellent defensively, and then the Saints, who are also very underrated defensively. Then it's Pittsburgh, Tampa, and then on yards allowed, do you know who the number six defense in the NFL is right now? It's your Washington football team. However, I will tell you that in rush defense, they're near the bottom. But Washington defensively has improved in almost every single defensive category and improved significantly from where they were last year. I'll get back to the Rams-Bucks game. I'm getting sidetracked here, but I wanted to mention this. You know, last year, Washington was the worst third down defense in the last, I think it was 7 years in the NFL. It may have been 6 or 7 years. It could have been 6 years, but I think it was seven. Worst third down defense in a long time in the NFL. And they have improved dramatically. To me, that is a number very important, both sides. Offensive and defensively. Take out all of the advanced analytics and statistics that are more advanced, a lot of the DVOA stuff that I cite from Football Outsiders. Third down stops and third down makes are very important. You either get the team off the field and force a punt or force a field goal, or you advance the ball and keep it for another three snaps minimum, which gives you more opportunity to not only move the football, improve field position, and potentially score points, it keeps the other team off the field and from the ability to score points on offense. And Washington was dead last year on third down defense. Right now, they are ninth in the NFL in third down defense. So sixth overall in yards allowed, which to me is a bit misleading because I don't think their rush defense has been very consistent, not consistent enough. But on third down, they are ninth from 32nd a year ago. That is a significant improvement. And when we debate, and we have over the last couple of weeks, about whether or not the defense is good or mediocre or, you know, on the verge of being really good, one thing we can all agree on, it is so much better than it was a year ago. And that's not saying much because it was pathetic a year ago. And it's been pathetic for basically a decade. They have had bad defensive football teams for a long time around here. This year's defense is it's approaching a good defense with the potential a year, 2 years down the road if they make the right moves and fill in the holes with good pieces to be potentially a very good defense with what they have up front. But all you got to look at is 32nd to 9th. In third down stops. That is a massive improvement and one of the reasons they are a significantly improved defense and have had a chance in games this year because of their defense. You can point to some of those games where maybe they gave up a lot late, but the reason they were in it early, especially early in the season, was their defensive football team. Now, back to last night. So one of the things that was interesting about the game last night, if you stayed up and watched it, there was literally no attempt by either team to rush the football. In the game, the Rams threw it 51 times and ran it 20 times. They ran it 20 times for 37 yards in the game. That was it. 20 carries, 37 yards for the Rams. They threw it 51 times. Meantime, the Patriots threw it 48 times and ran it 18 times. I bring this up because neither team trailed ever by more than one score. This was a back and forth game throughout. LA took a 7-0 lead. Tampa Bay came back to take a 14-7 lead. Then the Rams were up 17-14. And then the Rams, Buccaneers came back and tied it at 24-24 before a field goal with 2.5 minutes to go gave the Rams the final score of the game, a field goal that led to a 27-24 lead. In this day and age of football, sure, you can run the football and be a run-dominant team and be successful. We saw two of them last year make it a long way. First of all, in the regular season, the 49ers and the Ravens were both run-first teams. The Titans got to the AFC Championship being a dominant run team. But it's not the only way to do it. It never has been, and it never will be. Right now, Well, I shouldn't say it never has been. In the last 10 years of watching football minimum, there have been many teams that have used whatever it was necessary on that day to score points and to win games. We've seen the Patriots do it for years. Some days they run it. Some games they won. They ran it a lot more. And some games they won by throwing it a lot more. The Rams last night, ironically, threw it 51 times and ran it 20 times. Both rush defenses, by the way, are exceptional rush defenses in the NFL. The Rams, obviously led by Aaron Donald up front, are an exceptional rush defense. And the Buccaneers have a very good rush defense as well. So you have two teams that have done a pretty good job on the ground stopping people. Buccaneers have the number one rush defense in the NFL, and I think the Rams are in the top five. I think I saw that before the game last night. But what was really strange about this game is that Sean McVay had a third down and eight prior to what would be the go-ahead field goal and the game-winning field goal that came with 2 minutes and 36 seconds left. They were at the Tampa Bay 22-yard line. They had essentially used the pass to drive the ball all the way down the field. They started at their own 25. Goff threw on what turned out to be an eight-play drive. He threw the ball six of the eight plays. And then on third and eight at the Tampa Bay 22, and you have to think in that spot, right? You've got to think, we need a first down, be great to move the chains, really force Tampa Bay to use their timeouts, but really what we need out of this drive is we need a touchdown. We can't give Brady just the opportunity to come down and get a field goal. On third and eight, they just ran the ball. It wasn't a draw. It wasn't a spread the field. It was a pitch to Malcolm Brown and a running of the football for 0 yards. And they kicked the field goal in the next play, which was really a strange call for Sean McVay. Sean McVay usually a little bit more creative. I was wondering whether or not they were running the ball, if it was a check because they were, you know, facing six DBs and they thought they could actually get it. I don't think that was it at all. I think it was just super conservative. McVay saying, I'm not going to force anything with Goff. And by the way, in the game, Goff had thrown two interceptions like Brady as well. So perhaps he just didn't want to take the chance with Jared Goff. He wanted the three-point lead, and he trusted his defense, and it worked out because Brady, on a second and 10 from their own 38, plenty of time in the game, plenty of time. All they're needing is field goal range. They've already moved it from their own 19 to the 38. He throws a ball to nobody in particular. I think Cameron Brate was the intended receiver. He overthrew him by about a mile. And Jordan Fuller ended up with his second pick of the night. Game over. You know, the Patriots are now 7-4, 1-2 since Antonio Brown started to play. They've lost two games at home, not that it matters, although they do have some fans. They got blown out, remember, in the Sunday night game by the Saints a few weeks ago and then lost last night to the Rams on Monday Night Football. They get the Chiefs this Sunday. This is the big 425 highlighted national TV CBS game. Patriots hosting the Chiefs. They lose that game. All of a sudden, they are 7-5, and their playoff hopes are now teetering. I had the Buccaneers in the NFC Championship game and on to the Super Bowl. And they have a chance to fall to 7-5 on the year, which would really, in relation to the division, especially considering they've already been swept by the Saints, that would pretty much end their division chances. The Saints are 8-2. Now, the Saints this weekend have the Broncos on the road. They're favored. They would be 9-2. If the Bucs lose, they're at 7-5. They're not going to win the division. You can then count them out of the division race because not only would be that they would be three games behind, they'd in essence be four games behind the Saints because they were swept by the Saints. And then you've got a situation where the Buccaneers are fighting with teams like Seattle, Arizona, Chicago potentially for a wild card spot. Wouldn't be a lock for them. They have some big games left. You know, this team that I think, and I think many others thought, had a chance to get to the Super Bowl. In addition to the Chiefs, they play the Vikings. The Vikings have been playing well. They have to play at Atlanta. All right. The Falcons haven't been easy. And then they finish with the Falcons as well. And I think they've got a game with the Lions. Anyway, meantime, the Rams really strengthened their position. The problem with the Rams is their remaining schedule. As you look at it, they still have the Cardinals twice, the Seahawks, and the Patriots. They also play the banged-up 49ers and the Jets. But the Rams have quietly, and it's interesting the way they've done it, right? They haven't done it with the dominant offense, with dynamic offense. It's not the way they've done it this year. In their last four games, They have not scored in any of those games more than the 27 they scored last night, and that's the most. They beat the Seahawks last week 23-16. They only scored 17 against the Dolphins, 24 against the Bears, and lost to the 49ers, if you recall. That was a primetime game, 24-16. The Rams have scored, the last time they scored 30 was in Washington. Interesting team, the Rams. They are very good defensively. This is a different Sean McVay team. They rely more on their defensive side of the football with, you know, very arguably the best defensive football player in the league. Joe Barry's a part of that defensive staff, if you didn't know that, out in Los Angeles. All right, let's get to a what do you got or two. All right, good job. We're still feeling our way through the new spot here. It's going to take us a few days. You guys don't care about all that stuff anyway. I wanted to just mention a couple of things. First of all, one of the things I like to do on this show when it comes to this time of year is to give you a heads up on future weather. If you don't know this, I'm a massive winter weather geek. I look at all the long-range models, find out if we're going to have a snowstorm or cold weather. I'm actually getting to that point in my life where I really prefer warmer weather if it's not going to snow, but I love really good snowstorms. And all the weather geeks out there that are on the internet and on message boards, and they follow all the models, the GFS and the Euro and the NAM. Sounds like a different language to most of you. Some of you know what I'm talking about, and you can appreciate this. And you start to look at the long range. It's going to be a very nice week the rest of the week. I mean, Thanksgiving Day, we're going to have some rain early. And then it's going to warm up a little bit later in the day. We're going to get into the mid-60s. But this time next week, as in, you know, Tuesday, and that would be December 1st. A week from today is December 1st. We're talking about highs in the upper 30s to low 40s, hard freezes at night. And there are some indications in the long range, in the very long range, that, and we're talking about the first weekend in December and beyond, about it getting colder and stormier, and maybe having a stormy, colder December. A lot of those winter weather outlooks that people like Sue Palka, who's a good friend of mine, Doug Kammerer, who I like a lot, Topper Shutt, who I like a lot. I'm sorry, I don't know who does the weather on Channel 7. Those are the weather people I watch. I'm sure the person on Channel 7 is excellent. But they've all done their winter weather outlooks, and the Capital Weather Gang is one of my favorites. The Capital Weather Gang and the Capital Weather Gang saying more snow than last year, but we didn't have any snow last year. We had 0.6 inches. We had 0.6 of an inch of snow officially last year. I mean, there was no snow last year. We did not have winter last year. But a lot of them are predicting a milder than average winter with not a lot of snow again. We're in a La Nina year. But anyway, it's really hard to predict weather like a month in advance or 2 months in advance or 3 months in advance, like an entire winter. What is also hard to predict is what will happen a week from now, certainly 2 weeks from now. But I'm going to give you some of the week-long and two-week-long stuff on this show when it looks like there's potential. And I'm just telling you that the first weekend in December, that would be, I think, December 5th and 6th, it looks like it could be cold and stormy, and then even beyond that, the same. So if you like cold weather, you like snow and the potential for snowstorms, this is going to be your show during the course of the winter. Because one, I'm not going to give you a forecast here. I'm not going to tell you what's going to happen the next couple of days. You can get that, you know, on your phone. I'm going to tell you what the long-range GFS tells you about 14 to 16 days out. And whether or not there's a chance at something developing. It's usually wrong, but it doesn't matter. Sometimes it ends up being right. Hey, one other quick thing I wanted to just mention. The Joe Burrow injury. Did you guys see this? It was the worst case on the injury, because it was not only a torn ACL and torn MCL, but Dr. James Andrews apparently also talked about more damage, more underlying damage to the knee. I think it was Schefter who tweeted out that there are structural issues to the knee and that this is not the typical 9-month return from an ACL or, you know, a combined ACL, MCL. This is a year-long thing. So it is possible, based on where we sit today in that report, that Joe Burrow could miss much of, if not the entire 2021 season. And we may not see Joe Burrow back in uniform until 2022. I hope that's not the case. That's a brutal blow from a guy who was playing at a high level. In his first 10 games, he ranks fourth in NFL history for the most passing yards in a player's first 10 games. He had thrown for 2,688 yards. At the halfway mark of the season, he was on pace, before they played the Steelers last week, he was on pace to break Andrew Luck's record for the most passing yards ever by a rookie, which was 4,374 yards. Ryan Finley becomes their starting quarterback. Zach Taylor did hint that they may sign other quarterbacks out there. And Colin Kaepernick put out a tweet yesterday that read, 1,363 days of being denied employment, still putting in the work with Eric Reed, still going hard 5 days a week, hashtag still ready, hashtag stop running. Eric Reed's been, was offered an opportunity to join Washington's practice squad. We know that, and he decided to pass on that opportunity of employment. Kaepernick didn't suggest that Reed had been denied employment. He just suggested in his tweet that he's putting in the work with Eric Reed. But 1,363 days of being denied employment, of course, as we know, is an interesting way to put it, considering the league and the commissioner in particular went and jumped over hoops to create an opportunity for him last year in Atlanta, and he decided to pass on that and turn it into an absolute charade. Maybe this is the opportunity in Cincinnati. You know, Ryan Finley played a preseason game here last year and was super impressive. I think he was like 23 of 28 in a preseason game. I understand that. But he looked the part in terms of being that pocket kind of quarterback at NC State when he was there. It would not surprise me if he plays better than he played on Sunday. You know, and for Washington in this race that they are in the NFC East, you need Ryan Lindley to play well, because they play the Giants this week, and in 3 weeks, they play the Cowboys. You know, they've played the NFC East, and they're the only ones against the NFC East with a losing record at 0-1-1. They tied Philly, and they lost to Washington. All right, when we come back, quick word about John Wall and what Tommy Shepard said yesterday. Then we'll get to some of the Ron Rivera stuff from yesterday. Mike Wilbon at 8 a.m. this morning on the show. You're listening to the Kevin Sheehan Show on the Team 980, theteam980.com, and also now on the radio.com app.
The Kevin Sheehan Show on the Team 980 and the radio.com app.
So, you know, during the last week and a half, I mean, we had the NBA draft. A lot of you weren't paying attention to it. I honestly believe it was the least paid attention to NBA draft in history. Didn't get a chance really to see a lot of the college players. We rarely know the foreign players anyway. NBA free agency started after that. And then came all of the news related to your Washington Wizards. By the way, the team over the weekend did actually get Davis Bertans re-signed to a long-term deal, which was really, to me, a big thing. Bertans, at his size, I'm not sure I've seen anybody have the ability to shoot it the way he's able to shoot it. Not only has he got a pure stroke, he's got a quick stroke, and he's big. at 6'10". And Tommy Shepard actually said he's one of the most underrated transition defenders in the league. So they got him signed to a big deal. He signed an $80 million deal for 5 years. So Bertans is staying. If they had lost them, that would have been a big loss, especially considering that they had an opportunity potentially last year prior to the trade deadline to get a first rounder, and they could have done a sign and trade. But whatever, Davis Bertans is in. Now the question is about John Wall. The Athletic had the report last week about John Wall for Russell Westbrook. Tommy Shepard, the Wizards GM, who we had on the show last week. And he said about the report about conversations about Wall and Westbrook. He didn't deny it. This is what he, though, said yesterday.
There's no plans to trade John. Obviously, it's unfortunate this time of year. I think the bait and tackle shop's wide open for business. There's a lot of people that get excited on the internet or whatnot. But I was with John this morning. I watched him work out. He had another fantastic workout. Talked to all of our players. I talked to Bradley today. He's excited about getting back here, getting ready to get to training camp. You know, I think the story, it's a new story now with John and Bradley versus it's not a sequel. They haven't played together in 2 years, but they both look forward to playing with each other. And that's where we're at, and that's where we move on to. I'm not sure the second part of your question, how do we get to wherever it is? I'd leave it up to you. I can't respond to rumors. I can't respond to things that float around out there other than just keep our head down and do what's best for the Wizards. We've been pointing to this time for a long time to try to see how we can get those guys back on the floor together, because when we were together last, they were pretty darn good, one of the best backcourts out there. We've added a lot of pieces. We've changed a lot of significant pieces since they were last together. But one of the biggest things we did, we had the opportunity to re-sign Davis Bertans. And I think that gives John another shooter that is just going to only add to his amazing passing abilities. It helps Bradley and his opportunities to go out and create for himself, for others. And it opens up the floor wide for kids like Thomas Bryant, Rui Hachimura. We're really excited to see what we have in our rookies and see what Troy Brown can do, and et cetera, as we get ready for this training camp ahead of us. We are all in. We're all excited.
So there you go. That was Tommy Shepard from yesterday, basically saying there are no plans to trade John, and that John hasn't, that he doesn't have an issue with John, and John hasn't asked for a trade. All right. So there are a lot of things here to consider. And a lot of what you would form an opinion based on isn't available to us. The most important thing being, can John Wall still play? You know, what is he going to be coming off his injury? We don't have the answer to that. You know, Tommy Shepard's told me now twice, Scott Brooks has told me this twice on this show over the last 4 to 5 months, that John may be better than the last time we saw him physically, because he was physically impacted the last time we saw him. And that they don't expect John to lose any of his explosiveness, any of his speed. But we don't know that, and no one's going to really know that until we see him on the floor playing games that matter. That's the biggest part of this that makes it really hard to form an opinion. What do you have in John Wall? Because the part that you know is you've got $135 million left on his contract. And if somebody were willing to take that off your hands for a player that you think is never going to be physically the same again, will you make that trade? You know, Ernie was able to dump Gilbert Arenas, remember, with those bad knees in a swindle deal with Orlando and with Otis Thorpe, who I think was the GM at the time. And so if Tommy Shepard were thinking deep down that there is more of a chance that John Wall's not John Wall anymore than he is, then you're looking to deal him. If he isn't, then from a basketball standpoint, I don't know if you trade him for what I would refer to, you know, in Russell Westbrook's case, even though I'm a massive Russell Westbrook fan, a depreciating asset, a depreciating player. Russell Westbrook continues to put up massive numbers, but in games that matter, we've seen a lesser player in recent years. I love Russ. Nobody tries harder in sports than Russell Westbrook. Nobody does. But I am not willing to trade John Wall if it's a healthy John Wall, you know, a potentially healthy John Wall, for Russell Westbrook. I wouldn't do it, despite the fact that I think it would be some there would be some buzz around it. There would actually be legitimate buzz around John Wall for Russell Westbrook, Westbrook playing in Washington. But you're not getting Westbrook. And you're getting a player who, as much as I love Westbrook, just you can't win it. You can't win a lot with him. Not anymore. Not if he's your, you know, number one or number two option. And he's got to be. But here's the other part with Wall. And that is, even if he is healthy, and even if Tommy Shepard and Ted Leonsis and Scott Brooks believe in Wall having the ability to come back and play at a high level again, there is concern in the organization about John Wall's marketability. There is, and I know this for a fact, there was a lot of unhappiness. Tommy Shepard told us this last week on the show. There was a lot of disappointment. We'll describe it as disappointment. When John Wall was at that party in Brooklyn, and he was, videotaped flashing gang symbols with both hands. Now, he later apologized profusely. You know, he apologized. He said, quote, "First and foremost, I want to apologize to my family, my teammates, and all of those that have supported me and always supported me. I made a mistake, something I regret. I will continue to work hard to be better on the court and, more importantly, off the court." That's what Wall wrote after that incident. I believe the Wizards were very upset. Again, Shepard said very disappointed in that. But, you know, they've talked to John, and John apologized in a very sincere way from their standpoint. A lot of you don't understand this, but I'm going to try to explain it to you. The NBA is a big business, and the big corporate sponsors and the big ticket owners, and I'm not talking about the one-offs. I'm not talking about some of you who own two season tickets or maybe four. I'm talking about the businesses that buy them in blocks. I'm talking about the businesses that buy suites. I'm talking about a business that relies very much on corporate revenue, corporate sponsorships, ticket sales, big ticket sales, premium ticket sales. This is not the NFL. Now, it's not the NHL either, you know, where the paltry television contracts in comparison make live gate critical to the economics of the NHL. But for basketball, the live gate, the live attendance economics are crucial. You know, the corporate sponsorships and the money they generate off of the team and the potential of the team is huge. And a lot of those people, they don't understand that what John did may have been totally benign, totally innocent. So you can't explain and you can't reason with people that don't understand and aren't identifying or familiar with whatever this culture is that a lot of you have said to me makes what John Wall did in Brooklyn a very innocent, benign event. Ted's running a business. Do you know that essentially the Wizards, until the last deal, until the last collective bargaining agreement, they needed playoff games, at least two or three at home, to even break even? A lot of people have suggested that this pandemic, and if you get another NBA season without a lot of fans, you're going to lose some franchises. Same in the NHL. You're going to lose franchises, potentially. So these things matter to the business of these teams. These things matter, whether they are truly at their core benign events, innocent events, insignificant events. It's the perception. They're selling perception. They're certainly not selling winning. They're selling stars. John Wall's been one of their stars. John Wall doesn't get in trouble. John Wall is a good guy. John Wall's been a good player. But there's been some immaturity there as well. And he needs to understand at $43 million a year the things he can't do, because to pay his salary or to have his employer continue to desire to pay his salary, he's got to be a part of the business. He's got to understand what he can and can't do, what he can do to help generate revenue, and what he can't do to hurt generating revenue. These are things that sometimes employees don't get. You know, high-priced employees in particular have to have a much bigger picture in mind. They have to understand the reason they're making big salaries is because the owner and the business people in the organization believe that they can generate a lot more than what they will pay that person. If that person's on-court performance doesn't match up to the salary, but they're doing their best, so be it. But the things they can control, their off-court behavior, and John's never gotten in trouble. I understand that. You know, John's compared to a lot of athletes in sports, Wall never gets in trouble. He's never been arrested. John is phenomenal in the community. He has been incredibly generous in the community. Whether or not that is self-serving or whether or not that is genuinely caring, I can't comment on because I don't know John Wall. My sense is that John feels he owes something to this community, and he does the right thing when it comes to those things. And it's easy for us to say what the right thing is, but he's engaged in the community. But you got to understand, your actions off the court can hurt the people that are paying your exorbitant salary. And you have to have those things in mind. That's maturity. That's responsibility. That's accountability. But it's also an understanding of, okay, so it doesn't just grow on trees. They're not just giving me this money because they just have so much of it. I have a responsibility to help them generate the revenue that supports my salary and Brad's salary and everybody else's, because we make a lot of money. And I think the team was very upset with what happened in Brooklyn. Less upset with the interview he did with Field Yates, where he was playing spades during the interview and was completely disengaged. And that was immature. But that doesn't hurt the potential business side as much as flashing gang symbols at a party in Brooklyn, which, again, he apologized for, which, again, may be very innocent and benign and insignificant for those that understand. But most of the people paying for the big corporate suites, paying big corporate money that helps pay John's salary, they may not understand. And that doesn't make Ted Leonsis happy or any of the business people happy. You got to have a bigger picture in mind when you are a high-priced employee. You have to think in terms of not did my check clear, but how are they generating the revenue to pay me? And how can I help them generate the revenue to continue to pay me? You got to have, and I know a lot of you out there are anti-management, but when you're making $43 million a year, you have to have, if you're mature and you understand big picture, and hopefully there are people around him, and Ted would be one of those, that can sit down and very simply draw out, this is what we generate in revenue as a team on an annual basis, and this is what our expenses are, and this is you as one of our expense lines. See how much that is? We need this revenue number to keep growing, which means I need you to perform on the floor and we need to win games, but I also need you to understand that when you're off the floor. And again, I'm not berating John. He's been outstanding off the floor. He's been generous. He's never been in trouble. But I can tell you, this organization was not pleased with that. That does not help their revenue generation efforts. As far as John Wall staying here, I can't answer that because I don't know his health. If he is healthy, I'd prefer it to be John Wall and Bradley Beal and Davis Bertans and anybody else they can add to it, because I think it's actually with a healthy John Wall, even if Bradley Beal is the number one go-to of the pair, I think they can win enough games to be a playoff team and maybe even win a playoff series. The last time we saw everybody healthy, they were in a seventh and deciding game against the Celtics. And they were close. And John Wall was at maybe his highest level. He certainly was in the series prior to the Celtics series when he put on an all-time legendary performance in franchise history in the postseason, going for 42 points in Game 6 in a closeout in Atlanta in the first round. It was a brilliant performance where at one stretch in a close game, he scored 17 of the team's 18 points and I think had three steals in the process. I hope John Wall's healthy. I hope John Wall continues to understand the big picture of an organization like the Wizards, which isn't the Lakers. All right, it doesn't have an unlimited revenue stream to support all of these contracts. I hope it works out with him here. I've enjoyed watching him play when he's been at his best. When we come back, you'll hear some of what Ron Rivera said yesterday. And then we'll get to the question of the day and open up phone lines. And we're back to our old phone number, just for a day. I told you it would be for just a day. 301-230-0980. Kevin Sheehan Show, Team 980, the Team 980, team980.com. And now on the radio.com app, a great app, a better app than the one we used to have. Go to radio.com, download the app, and you can listen very easily there.
The Kevin Sheehan Show on the Team 980 and the radio.com app.
And Samaje Perine to Ryan Finley's left, two wide receivers to the right. Washington brings six. Big hit by Sean Dion Hamilton, and that one is picked off by Fabian Moreau at the Cincinnati 45. Sean Dion Hamilton decked Finley as he was throwing that, and an interception for Moreau.
And he runs it back as the DBs do. That's a rule that they have. Anytime you take a pick, you got to run it on back. Chris Harris, their DB coach, leads that one. He's typically one of the most energetic on the field. Good for Fabian.
Did Fabian get a run back on that? I thought he was marked down on that play. Fabian Moreau, he's had interceptions. I think he's got two. And in the two games in which he's had interceptions, they've won both games. Remember that Eagles interception by Moreau was the biggest play of the game. Came right before the end of the first half. I think he's got two. I think that's what he has. He's barely played at times this year since early in the season. Right now, the interception leader, Fuller's still at four, Moreau's at two. They don't have a lot of interceptions on this season. Apke should have had one the other day. Moreland's got one. Holcomb's got one. Collins has one. He had that one in the Arizona game. And then Moreau's got the two, the other one the other day, really being meaningless at the end. The one in Philadelphia or against Philadelphia in the opener being significant. By the way, we will have Kendall Fuller on the show tomorrow. We look forward to having really a guy who I thought both Fuller and Darby in particular played very well and have been playing well for them this year. Ultimately, Washington and their free agent class in this offseason has turned out pretty well. First of all, you look J.D. McKissic, who was a good pickup. Logan Thomas wasn't a bad pickup. Cornelius Lucas is playing well for them. And then defensively, Fuller and Darby, and even KPL to a certain degree, Kevin Pierre-Lewis, they've gotten pretty good production out of their free agents. Give them credit for pretty well in free agency without breaking the bank on any of these players. Really, the player they wanted to break the bank on was Amari Cooper, and they will face him on Thanksgiving Day. The last time they faced the Cowboys on Thanksgiving Day, it was shortly after the Cowboys had traded for Amari Cooper, and Cooper ended up having a big day on that Thanksgiving in a 31-23 lead. Tomorrow will be very much for us a football Friday kind of show, although we'll have another one on Friday, but we'll have an early smell test tomorrow. We will have Washington wins if, and as I mentioned, Kendall Fuller will be on the show as well. All right, Ron Rivera spoke yesterday. There are a couple of sound bites that I wanted to play from his presser. the day after the game. First of all, you know, after this win on Sunday, which came after some close losses, he was asked about the team learning how to win. Here's what he said.
There are different ways to learn to win. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you know, when you're on the road, you score at the very end, you've got momentum, you know. Things say that stats have said that the home team tends to win more when you're on, you know, so your opportunities, you try to take them. Sometimes you may not be playing your best football. You may not have a lot of big plays, but if you systematically run the ball and grind the clock and control it, you can control the tempo defensively if you're shutting down the run and you're getting pressure on the quarterback. You're allowing the DBs to make plays. Yeah, there are different ways to win. And yesterday was a little bit more of a workman type of football game. Because I don't think we played our best football. And I do think we had some individuals that did step up and play really well. You know, I thought Ronald Darby had a really good game for us. That was good to see. I think some of the guys on the defensive line, you know, came up with big plays at the right moment. Chase being one of those guys. You know, and some of his pressures led to some other good things for guys around him. So, yeah, I would say it was a workman type of game.
I thought that answer was interesting, the way he started it with there are different ways to learn to win, and as far as I'm concerned, and he took that opportunity to almost go back to the Giant game when he went for two. Because remember when he said, this was, we're playing to win, and we're playing to teach these guys how to learn to win. And when you're on the road, you go for the win. And when you're at home, you tend to, you know, play it differently. And the game Sunday had nothing to do with any of that, right? And he said, as far as I'm concerned, when you're on the road and you score at the end and you've got momentum, things say that stats have said the home team tends to win more, so your opportunities you try to take then. Somehow he took that question and went back to you know, the Giant game from the Meadowlands. But anyway, I also thought it was interesting that he said, I don't think we played our best football. And I think really what he was referring to as much as anything was defensively. You know, they played very much a bend don't break game Sunday. You know, we talked about that a little bit yesterday, and they didn't want to give up the big play. They didn't want to give up the big play to Boyd. They didn't want to give up the big play to Green. They certainly didn't want to give up the big play to T. Higgins. And so it was a strange game Sunday with the injury, of course. And then I really think they took their foot off the pedal in the second half of that game. All right, we got to get to a break. I do want to play more from Rivera, including what he said about the divisional race, because that will lead to a question on the following. Because right now, the NFC East, especially with Philly losing and Wentz looking terrible, you know, Philly, even through this terrible division, you know, 9, 10, 11 weeks into it now, Philly's been the consistent division favorite pretty much since, I don't know, week two or three, somewhere in there, week four. Whenever Dak got hurt, Philly became the obvious favorite. And now it is a complete toss-up. You have four teams, essentially three teams with the same record at 3-7, and the Eagles at 3-6-1, and they look like right now the worst team in the division. They may be the worst team in the division right now. So the question will be, and you can start lining it up on the phones at 301-230-0980, who's going to win the NFC East? I want to gauge your reaction to this right now, because this could be the last time that we have it this bunched up. Somebody could pull away here. Who's it going to be? Who's the favorite right now in your mind to win the division? Philadelphia, the Giants, the Cowboys, or Washington? You'll hear what he said about the divisional race when we come back. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, the Team980.com, and now on the Radio.com app.